right, and welcome to Hollywood Blockbusters. I am your host, Joel Hollywood. And once again, I'm joined by Imaginos Pete.
Hey, hey.
And Andrew.
Andrew, I'm the only one in this room born in the 80s. Woohoo!
That's tragic.
Well, I hope there was a VHS machine playing when you came out of the womb.
Oh, there
was. You needed to jump on it.
There was.
Shots fired in the opening. My God.
Now, boy, today's topic are blockbuster movies of the 80s. And Andrew suggested it, but I am excited because in 1980, I turned 14. I graduated from high school in 1984, had my first car in the 80s, first job in the 80s. The 80s were my formative years, and I will go to my grave arguing that the 80s was the best decade for movies. You got Spielberg and so many great movies that came out in the 80s, and just the memories, especially when I got my car, of gathering friends up and going to the theater and standing in line. You know, the term blockbuster was coined in 1975 with Jaws.
Yep.
And there was a period of time where we lined up around the block waiting and hoping we were going to get in to see a movie. And if that one sold out, you went to the next one. It was a great time to be alive, great time for a movie buff. Nick, how old were you in the 80s?
I'm born in 79.
So. Ah, so those are your early memories.
Yeah, so I grew up in the 90s, like, you know, so
yeah.
My formative years from the 90s, but I had a lot of 80s influences, and a lot of the movies that I look at as Hall of Famers, I reference the 80s. Look, yeah. If you're making an argument as the 80s is the best decade for the movies, you got a hell of a strong argument.
I mean,
look, you can point to Jaws and Star Wars in the 70s. And,
yeah.
But you talk about 80s from entire decade.
Yeah.
You know, when I was looking through this list, we were doing research for this, I was going 80, 81, 82. I was like, oh my God, they're gold jackets. So that's Hall of Fame reference for football.
Yeah.
There's, you know, they're Hall of Famers, and they would belong on AFI's top 100 or whatever list you want to do, top 100.
Sure.
Yep.
There's at least one in every year.
I was going to say every single year.
In every genre.
Yeah. Yep.
In every genre. You want to go action, you want to do fantasy, you want to do drama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on my 100 favorite movie list, I would say maybe at least half are movies from the 80s.
Wow.
And again, I'm partial because those were my formative years. But, you know, a lot of the movies that are on my list were the top grossing movies for each year of that decade. So not only were they commercial successes, they were critical successes and just huge hit with fans. And to be in a movie theater in the 80s was something special. Movies that are considered beloved classics today, I got to see for the first time in a crowded theater, cheering and applauding and laughing, mm-hmm. and crying. It's it was just a great time to be a movie buff.
And it's one of the it's weird because I was thinking about this. It's one of the harder ones to make remakes for. I mean, they've done RoboCop, they've done Little Mermaid, but
yeah.
It's because you can't. I mean, has anyone done Indiana Jones? No.
Right.
No.
Back to the Future.
And if they ever try.
They will. No. Andrew, you know Hollywood. You know how money works. They will. But there are certain people that still exist right now that they can't do it for.
Hollywood always tries to go back to the well. And more often than not, it fails. When you look at remakes of RoboCop and Fright Night, those did not do well at the box office. And now there's talk of a remake of The Crow, which was that 80s or was that 90s?
That's 90s.
That's 90s.
But still.
Just don't. Yeah. Don't.
Highlander, the potential reboot with Henry Cavill.
Henry Cavill.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
So,
they nip at the edges of the 80s.
Yeah.
But for the big Mount Rushmores of the 19 movies, they're not touching them because who wants that pressure? And the legends, you know, Marty and Doc are still around.
Right.
Yeah.
Indy's still around, the originals.
Yeah. So
tough to touch them.
Yep.
You know, it's different. Like, you know, there were movies that were remade many times in the 30s and 40s and stuff, but that's because people didn't have them in their collections. Like, a movie came out, it was in the theater for a year or so, and then it pretty much vanished forever. And so a few years later, Hollywood would take another stab. A perfect example is like A Star Is Born. That's been remade many, many times. The problem with trying to remake movies 70s and 80s is that I, for one, have all those movies in my collection, and if I want to see them, I pop it in and watch it. Right. I don't want to see new actors delivering the same lines in a remake.
Or The Fly. There was A Fly before the 80s one, but everyone remembers The Fly.
With Vincent Price, right?
Vincent Price was in the original, yeah.
And then everyone remembers Jeff Goldblum's because just of the special effects and you know, how Gina Davis performed in it.
Yeah.
But when they think of The Fly, they think, oh, the 80s. Like, no, we're talking about the Vincent Price one. But that remake... They were going to do that, you know. I mean, it's 80s, man.
Yeah. All right. So what I'm going to do and encourage you guys to do the same is I have a list here of my favorite blockbuster movies of the 80s. These were the ones that were enormously popular with filmgoers. And I'm going to kind of start off the list and we'll go around the table and talk about some of your favorite blockbusters of the 80s. These are the biggest movies of the 80s. Now, when it came time for me to come up with number one on my list, I struggled a little bit because there are two movies in the 80s that had such a huge impact on me, and I have vivid, visceral memories of seeing them in the theaters. And they can be one and two. They can be two and one. It's very hard to separate these. But when it comes down to it, the number one movie for me from the 1980s. I gotta go with Indiana Jones. It came out in the early 80s, 1981 to be specific.
Oh, you didn't pick Temple of Doom as your number one?
We'll talk about Temple of Doom a little bit later. But, you know, here, I knew Harrison Ford as Han Solo, and, you know, there's always actors who complain about being typecast, and he easily could have been typecast as Han Solo, but he shakes that character off and embodies Indiana Jones and starts a whole new thing, and then the guy makes a career out of these iconic characters throughout his
acting career. He's typecast as Han Solo, right. Indiana Jones, Jack Ryan.
Yeah.
Blade Runner. I mean, it was really like your typecast.
And then he did Regarding Henry and some of the
dramatic stuff.
So I'm glad he was never like truly like pigeonholed.
Exactly. Yeah. And so to see the actor who played Han Solo embody Indiana Jones and start a new franchise, that was really thrilling for me as a teenager. And I may have shared this before, but my memory of seeing Indiana Jones in the movie theater is my mom, single mom, four kids, would take us to the dollar show to see movies. And the theater would play a movie and then start another movie and then play the first movie, start and then replay the second movie. And as this mom and four kids walk into the auditorium, it's halfway through Raiders of the Lost Ark. So we find some open seats. We sit down. I watch the second half of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Then we sit through a completely a separate movie. I can't remember which one it was. But then we stayed to watch the first half of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And that's how I saw Raiders for the first time. It didn't kick off with the boulder scene. That was in the middle for me. But Simpler I times. Instantly fell in love with that movie.
Simpler times.
Oh, it was amazing. So this is weird. There are different sources online. When I was researching what the top grossing movies were for various years, there are conflicting sources out there. You got Box Office Mojo, which I depend on heavily, but Box Office Mojo has different analytics, I guess, than some other sources like Wikipedia, where sometimes you factor in just domestic gross, worldwide gross, or what they gross that calendar year.
Yeah.
And so as I was looking at Box Office Mojo, Raiders of the Lost Ark was listed like 12th or something. I'm like, that doesn't sound right.
It sounded because it made it to the other year.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think at the time, it set a record for the amount of time it was in theaters. It was in theaters for like a year.
Oh.
Now, most would agree that it was the top grossing movie of 1981, despite what Box Office Mojo says. It grossed $212 million domestically, $390 million worldwide total. And I think it's one of the most perfect movies ever made. Doesn't miss a beat. It dabbles in the supernatural religious realm, which, you know, kind of taps into viewers' fears and anxieties, the wrath of God and all that stuff. And that sort of set the tone for the Raiders movies. That's what was so weird when a movie like, you know, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull came out, that they dabbled in sci-fi and UFOs. Yeah. And I'm like, that doesn't feel right to me.
It misses the vibe.
Yeah, and then they redeemed themselves with Last Crusade and, of course, the Holy Grail, which is part of that whole mythos. So, in my opinion, Raiders of the Lost Ark is one of the greatest movies ever made. Mm-hmm. The only movie that had more of an impact on me was Star Wars. That came out in 1977. So if we're just talking about 80s movies, Raiders of the Lost Ark, in my opinion, is the greatest movie of the 80s. Can you guys contribute anything to that? Nick, what you got?
Yeah, I mean, look, I you're asking me to pick and do an impossible action here. So that's why I defer to a Mount Rushmore. So this way, at least I get four, and before someone has to, I miss someone. Raiders, Empire Strikes Back are going to be up there. Back to the Future, just because I enjoyed that franchise. As silly as it is, I enjoyed that franchise. And I would have to say there was a stretch of, because they all came out in the 80s, Star Trek 2, 3, and 4, Wrath of Khan, Search for Spock, The Voyage Home, like that, because you could basically start from one and end with the other, because it was just one after the other.
Mm-hmm.
And
Let me ask you this about Raiders of the Lost Ark. First, let me play this.
No time to argue. Throw me the idol. I throw you the whip.
Give me the whip.
Adios, senor.
Let me ask you this. Now, I saw Raiders in the theater when it was fresh, when it was new, when we had never seen anything like it outside of the early serials of the 30s and 40s. When did you first see Raiders, and what was your reaction? Did you see it on video, I assume, or cable?
I saw it on VHS. I saw it on videotape. I was about 8 years old, so I saw it well after it came out, and it terrified me. Because first, I was in India at the time, and I went, oh, what's all this? And I saw people getting, like, killed, and I'm like, oh my god, and bats and snakes, and you know, especially the crypt scene. Snakes, why does it have to be snakes? You know, so it really affected me. But I was afforded the opportunity, because in the 90s I think they were doing a re-release, and I think there were some individual theaters that say, hey, we're doing an individual for this week, Raiders is coming out. This Birmingham and a few other theaters would do that. They'd take a nostalgic movie. So I said, I have to see. You know, my brother would always say, you know, you never saw Raiders, and it's different when I'm watching it.
Oh, it is, yeah.
So I sat down, and then when you see it on a bigger screen in a darkened theater with people all around you, we talked about this, the vibe is different.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I went, ah, there it is. There's the boulder coming down.
Yeah. Yeah, and those are classic movie moments. Every movie on my list generated classic lines from the movie. You know, Indy saying it's not the years, honey, it's the mileage.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. It's stuff you remember, and then when you watch the movie again for the 10th or 20th time, you go, there it is. There's the line. There's the scene. There's the moment. The face melting at the climax of the movie was, I mean, it was so cartoony, because you know a face wouldn't do that under those conditions. But it was kind of horrific. Like, what is happening?
Bad dates.
Yeah. That's right. They killed the monkey. Andrew, what are your memories of seeing Raiders of the Lost Ark?
I saw it. It must have been 89 or 90. So I would have been probably 5 or 6. And around the same time that I saw two other of my movies that are on this list, which I'll talk about later. Now, I don't remember if my parents recorded it, like, off of TV. It would have been, like, its network, you know, release. We didn't have cable, and we didn't buy very many VHSs at that point. So I think they must have recorded it off of TV. I absolutely loved it. as much as I loved seeing the first Star Wars movie I saw was at the time Empire Strikes Back. The second. That's what I saw first. I saw that before at any other Star Wars movie. I loved it. I loved the action adventure. I loved, of course, like everybody does, the John Williams score.
Yeah. Oh my god.
That his score, like it makes those movies big time. Imagine those Star Wars and Indy without John Williams. Yeah. I mean, they're completely different movies.
Yeah. Imagine if they went with the 80s techno sound, you know. Danny and there's a lot of 80s movies that have that.
And it works for certain movies,
yeah,
right,
but not for that genre.
Yeah.
The ending, though, you know, when they open up, that the faces melt, me being a 5 or 6 year old kid, that frightened me.
Yeah, that but sticks with you.
Do you remember after that, there's a demon that like
the ghost,
ghost that like slowly puts its face up like this.
And at first he's like beautiful.
Right. And then it
that's a nightmare inducing stuff.
Terrified me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I will never forget that.
That's why they have ratings, Andrew.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about this in a second, but Spielberg is the reason why they added ratings since then, that PG-13 rating. Because,
after Temple.
Yeah, you go see a movie like Raiders of the Lost Ark, and you bring the kids, and then you're like, oh, my God, my kids are scarred for life.
Also, at the beginning of the film, when the character played by Alfred Molina,
got the spikes through him.
He betrays Indy. No, for the golden statue.
Yeah.
And then he's got is it an arrow?
Yeah, the spike.
No, he broke the sunlight or whatever, and those spears came out and got him as he was running back in the opposite direction. So he was kind of pinned against the wall with spears coming out of him.
Didn't pay attention to what Indy was telling him on the way in.
Yeah.
I mean, look, for my Mount Rushmore, I left off Ghostbusters, Aliens, I mean, Goonies.
Oh, we'll get to those. We'll get to those in a second.
That's where the 80s is. I mean, that's why Joe's like, what's your best one? Like, oh, I got to cop out and take four.
It's tough.
And I don't come across any Indiana Jones movies like playing on, if I'm surfing through cable, like on TBS or anything. But if any, even Temple, if any of those three movies are playing, I'll stop it and at least watch, you know, wherever it is, watch a good 15 minutes of it.
Yeah.
And just to remind myself of
how good it is. Yeah, you know, I see people on social media, they're like, name a movie that you've seen more than once. And I'm like, what movie haven't I seen?
Yeah,
like,
how much time do you have?
Everything. Like, Raiders is right up there as far as movies I've seen easily dozens of times.
When people ask that question, I can't help it if that's like a passive-aggressive slap at how I use my time. You watch a lot of movies. I'm like, maybe I do, but Jesus.
It's my escape. Gosh, we're almost 20 minutes into the podcast. We've only touched on Raiders. I'm going to go on to number two. Let me play a little clip here, and then I'll share my memories of it.
Steven Spielberg presents Back to the Future, a Robert Zemeckis film. Marty leads an ordinary life.
No McFly ever amounted to anything in the history of Hill Valley.
Yeah, well, history is going to change.
And 1985 is not his year. But Dr. Brown is about to change all that.
Are you telling me that you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
This movie had such a huge impact on me.
Huey Lewis.
What's that?
Huey Lewis in the News.
That's right. Now, here's my memory of seeing it. I went to the Abbey Theater, which is on Maple, right off of I-75 there. It's now like a computer place or something where it was.
Yeah.
And I remember, this may shock you, but I remember begrudgingly going to see it because my sisters wanted to see it because Heartthrob, Michael J. Fox was in it and, you know, of Family Ties fame. And I thought it was going to be some, you know, teeny bopper thing. I was like, all right. And we went to Abbey Theater, and I came out of that theater a different person. Like, that was unlike anything I had ever seen. And just recently, I watched a TikTok video of a woman watching that movie for the first time. So I got to see her reaction of watching Back to the Future for the first time. And I literally had tears in my eyes seeing it through her eyes for the first time and watching her go, that's your mother. What are you doing, Marty? And I'm like, yes, that was us in the theater. Like, what is happening here?
Jesus, and, you smoke too?
What are you, my mother? And so that movie's had such a huge impact on me. And I remember when I was living in L.A. in 1990, my aunt and uncle wanted to go to Universal Studios. And I said, yeah, I'll tag along. And so we were taking the tram tour, and imagine rounding the corner, and we're in Hill Valley, the town square, the courthouse. I'm getting emotional thinking about it. It was still set up from shooting the back-to-back sequels, and so they had reverted it back to 1985, town square, I think it was. And the DeLorean was sitting on the lot, and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. And since then, I've visited most of the filming locations, from the mall where they first go back in time to the McFly home and all the other homes that are on the Pasadena Street. The school. I went to the school that was Hill Valley High. It's like, oh, they really cleaned up this place. It looks brand new. This movie ranks right up there as movies that had just a profound impact on me, and again, just the amazing memory of seeing it in the theater for the first time and seeing something I've never seen before. Nick, what's your memory of seeing Back to the Future?
I first saw it in India, and so for me, it was just, I didn't understand the concept at first, because the concept of time travel, because I was a young kid, I was about 7 or 8, I was like, oh, okay. Then upon repeat watching, I was like, oh, okay, I love it. And it was just the idea of adventure. This guy, everyone wanted to have like this uncle, Uncle Doc Brown. You know,
yeah, yeah.
It was the weird. I loved his house. I wanted to see what his place lived in. I never got to see that until the second movie.
Yeah.
When he saw what the 1955 Doc Brown lived like. This is an inventor's house.
Yeah, and that place, it's a famous historical attraction. It's called the Gamble House. That was built by one of the founders of Procter & Gamble. And if you catch it at the right time, you can actually tour it. And I got really lucky when I went to go visit it. The bookstore was open, which is now in Doc's garage. And so I wandered into this bookstore, and I'm like, this is cool. And then they were closing up for the day, so they closed the door. And once they closed the door, there you are standing at you expect him to open the door with the thing on his head, you know? It's really cool to see that in person.
For me, it's just that, you know, Great Scott used to be something that Superman would say, Great Scott. But now I felt that Doc and Marty hijacked it, because usually Great Scott, this is heavy. They almost go like peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah.
Hello? Hello? Anybody home? Hey, think with flying things.
Now, Tom Wilson, who plays Biff in the film, you know, he plays the bully in the film, but the actor is one of the nicest guys I've ever met. I've pretty much met the entire living cast of Back to the Future, and they're all so super nice, and Tom Wilson is just great. Unfortunately, you know, Michael J. Fox is pretty ill nowadays, and I went to Philadelphia at Fan Expo to see him in person, and unfortunately, you're kind of rushed through the line. He signed my little die-cast DeLorean. I got to say hi real quick before they shoved me out of there. So you don't get much of a one-on-one experience with Michael J. Fox anymore, but the other cast members are just really super friendly. So what's your experience?
Same thing with Indy. I'm pretty sure my parents recorded it on VHS when it was on network TV, and that, along with Indy and a couple other movies I'll mention in a little bit. It was on heavy rotation on Saturday mornings. My sister and I would watch the crap out of
After the cartoons.
I never saw the Back to the Future. Are you talking about the Back to the Future cartoon?
No. You got up on Saturday.
You got your bowl of cereal. You watched the Saturday morning cartoons.
Yeah, we would watch that afternoon. After 12 o'clock, yeah. But yeah, And I honestly, I may have watched, I don't remember specifically like I do with Star Wars, but I may have seen the second one, the second back, before I saw the first Back to the Future.
Interesting.
Back to the Future 2 is my favorite out of the series.
It is.
Yeah.
See, I there's aspects of it I love, but I felt it went too dark. And it's the same complaint that I have with Temple of Doom. It went really, really dark.
Are you speaking of the alternate 1985?
Yeah. And,
see,
and,
I like that. I felt that it added another layer, like, whoa, like, if you could go back in time and change one thing.
Yeah.
This might happen, butterfly effect, or whatever you want
to
call it.
To this day, one of the best explanations of time travel in movie going that I enjoy, where Doc's like, this happens. This is,
yeah.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not like Terminator time travel, which is like, oh, this is a headache.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, it's interesting. One thing I learned seeing movies in the 80s is that if there's a trilogy of movies, the middle one is always the dark chapter.
Yeah.
Empire Strikes Back is the darkest of the three original Star Wars
movies.
Absolutely. Same thing with Back to the Future, Temple of Doom.
Temple of Doom.
The middle chapter of the entire storyline is always dark. And like I said, I loved how they portrayed the future, which is so shocking to think that 9 years ago now. But yeah, it went so dark that, you know, Elaine was pretty much being held hostage by Biff. And imagine, you know, Marty seeing his mom being treated that way. That was kind of hard. But
and I love how they templated Biff after Donald Trump.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, to the point of having the big high rise with his name on it and everything. Yeah,
with the big comb over gold hair. Oh yeah, yeah.
No,
yeah. Absolutely.
I was lucky enough because I saw it. I saw all the movies pretty quickly, and then I came back here and I got to go on the ride. And if you ever never got a chance to go on the ride at Universal Studios, that's like the perfect comic because then you got to be in the world.
Oh,
you get to go to the time travel thing, and you get to. Mm. Doc's talking to you, you get to ride it, and you get to ride in his 8-person DeLorean.
Whoa.
And Biff steals the other DeLorean and is traveling through time. You're going through Hill Valley, like in the future, Hill Valley in the prehistoric past. Hill Valley in the Ice Age, and I'm like, this is awesome. I'm in the movie.
I have to see if there's like a YouTube video.
There is. There actually is. Okay. When you get a chance.
I'll check that out. That's right up my alley. Cool.
Say hi to your mom for me.
So, one final connection I have to Back to the Future is, again, when I was touring Universal Studios, part of the tram tour was a special effects demonstration, and they talked about blue screen, and they had the DeLorean and all that stuff. And then they said, we need a volunteer. And I was always, And they picked me from the crowd, took me backstage, put me in Doc's lab coat, put the white wig on me, and put me on the ledge of the clock tower. Now, not the actual clock tower that was in the Times Square or Town Square. It was in this soundstage or whatever. But basically I had those statues,
gargoyles.
Yeah, they were on either side of me, and I had to put the cable together. And so they say action, and the wind is whipping, and I'm trying to put the cable together. And then lightning strikes, and the platform spins, and I'm revealed to the audience to be a skeleton trying to put the thing together. Imagine being a Back to the Future fan, and I'm standing on the freaking ledge of the clock tower trying to put that cable together. That was a pretty awesome memory.
They say envy is a sin, Joe, and I'm trying not to do that, but you make it very difficult. Because Joe has a flux capacitor replica.
I have a huge collection of Back to the Future props. From the almanac to the flux capacitor, you name it.
You were kind enough to loan it to us for one of our shorts, which we're working on right now when we edit it, because it was one of those things. So it's one of those. It's such an iconic thing that it's now part of like our cultural zeitgeist. You know?
Yep. Yeah, it's pretty awesome to have those memories that I can pick up and touch. It's pretty cool. All right, I'm going to move on to number 3 on my list. This one came out in 1980. It was the top grossing movie, of course, of 1980, grossing $209 million and giving us one of the most iconic lines of the entire decade.
Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough. He told me you killed him.
No, I am your father.
Another thing that I get a kick out of is parents who show their kids that movie for the first time and record their reactions. And most of these kids are in disbelief. They turn to their parent and they go, he's lying to him, right? He's not Luke's father. And, God, seeing that in the theater for the first time, as, like I said, I was 14 years old or whatever, seeing it for the first time, such an iconic moment. And, you know, Star Wars, when it came out in 77, it had a huge impact on me. I got all the toys. I'd buy all the magazines. I was curious about how it was made. Imagine when they started revealing photos from the sequel. Like, what's that? What's a Tauntaun? You know, like seeing these images of these new creatures and new worlds and new stormtrooper armor designs.
And the AT-ATs.
That's one of the great, I mean, that it's so riveting, that whole attack.
Yep.
And, you know, I people today go, is that the most logical vehicle to use? I'm like, I don't care. It's cool. It's badass.
It's intimidating.
Those were awesome to see those on screen for the first time. The only complaint I have about Empire is it doesn't feel like a standalone movie, because I remember sitting in the theater and, you know, Luke gets his hand, spoiler alert, and they stand there at the window as they go, hey, we're going up to find Han on Tatooine. And it's like, okay. And the credits start rolling. They're like, wait a second, I thought you were going to Tatooine. Like, don't roll credits. I hated that. It just felt unfinished to me. And at the time, you had to wait 3 years for Return of the Jedi to come out. Not like, you know, the Harry Potter movies seemed like they came out every year. But it was tough seeing this movie, and it's such a great movie, but then to end on a cliffhanger was tough.
The Potter things, because when you got kid actors, you better start getting the production going, because they're going to turn into, you don't want like Luke Perry playing Harry Potter. It's like, aren't you 40?
Daniel Radcliffe smoking a cigarette.
Yeah.
You don't want to do Stranger Things season 5.
Right. Yeah, that's going to be, you know, everyone like, all of you have well past puberty. This is going to be very strange.
Yeah. But I think a lot of people would agree that Empire is one of the greatest sequels ever made. And, and what's kind of ironic about that is that it wasn't directed by George Lucas. You know, Star Wars almost killed George Lucas, so he turned the daily directing duties over to,
Irvin Kershner.
Irvin Kershner.
And he brought something to that film.
And he had Kazdan help him write it. That was one of the few times where George did the right thing in stepping back and just take the credit.
And I've said this before, and I hope it's not too controversial. George Lucas is a great ideas man. He's not great at writing or directing dialogue.
You can state facts. That's like saying 2 + 2 = 4. That's fine.
Empire and Jedi are, I think, much better directed movies compared to the first Star Wars.
If he had his way, Jedi would have been done by Spielberg, because he always wanted to give that to Spielberg, but then he quit. He dropped out of the DGA, the Directors Guild Association, because they kept knocking him for it. So why do you always put the credits at the end? You have to put the credits in the beginning, and I'm going to fine you for it. And I was like, wow.
I never heard that. Interesting.
He ticked people off. And it's so shocking to think, when you watch documentaries about the making of the Star Wars movies today, that the studios had no faith in these movies. They had to shop it around until 20th Century Fox took a chance on Star Wars, and now it's like easy money. But
Warner Brothers passed on it. Universal passed on it. And then Universal also passed on Harry Potter. So, you know, they were feeling really good. They also passed on this thing called Lord of the Rings. I was like, you guys are just like the Lions of the 90s.
And then, of course, there's the iconic moment where, you know, they're filming the scene in the carbon freeze chamber. And I guess they tried shooting several different takes and nothing seemed to work. And they were like, you know, Harrison, just come up with something.
I love you.
I know.
Just a few words became so iconic.
Completely
that
improvised.
Captured Han Solo so perfectly.
I love the director
saying it back.
Because I remember the curse was like, Harrison, don't think about it. Don't think about it. Just roll. Action. Roll. Just go with whatever comes to mind.
Yeah. And that works so well. So
that was the first real sci-fi movie I ever saw.
Yeah.
And still probably my favorite sci-fi movie of all time.
Yeah, yep. That is definitely one I will sit down and watch repeatedly. And I got to say this, too. When Lucas started re-releasing the upgraded versions of the movies, I feel like Empire is the most watchable of the upgraded versions. Like, those upgrades fixed a lot of mistakes, and they made Cloud City a little bit more real world, where they replaced walls with outdoor landscapes and stuff, and I can handle those changes. Now, Return of the Jedi and some of the changes
they
made.
The musical number he wanted to put in shows. Is that what you're talking about? The musical
tough.
At the end of Jedi?
They did change the Nub Nub song, but in Jabba's Palace, they changed the song Palace too, where they introduced those new characters.
And it's like an upbeat.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and the one guy, he's singing.
I was going, what are you doing?
Yeah, from Empire, the only two changes I remember is they show more of the snow monster,
the Wampa,
and they were more, like outside views, like you said, of
Cloud City,
and maybe a couple of the little airships,
flying around,
I don't remember if they made any other changes besides that, but that's what I remember.
Like I said, a lot of it was just fixing things. Like, and I've seen comparisons where
it added to it.
Yeah. But like during the AT-AT scene, when you look at the original film, like there are times where the cockpit of the snowspeeder is transparent, and you kind of see things moving through the cockpit. And I'm like, gee, I never noticed that before. So they fixed things like that, which was necessary.
Okay.
The other cool factor for Empire, among all the other things, Vader facing Luke and everything, was Boba Fett. Like, Empire Strikes Back gave us Boba Fett. And I remember as a kid, first seeing Boba Fett during the holiday special, there was an animated
sequence.
Just had
to bring it up.
I'm just going to refer to the animated part was pretty cool. And we were all like, who's this Boba Fett guy? So when he finally appeared in Empire, it was like, oh, he's so cool. And then Lucas, for whatever his reasons are, just killed him like a bitch in Return of the Jedi.
Boba Fett.
Luckily, they saved him and brought him back later. But, boy, I don't know why he dispatched him so easily with
he also did that with Darth Maul, and he shouldn't have. But anyway, that's another story.
Yeah, but he wrote and directed that.
Here, this will remind you of everyone getting tossed into the Sarlacc pit. The Wilhelm
scream. God bless the Wilhelm scream.
So, yeah, Empire Strikes Back. Man, it so much anticipation, and it delivered. It was great.
Mm-hmm.
The next movie that I was going to go to, again, this is not only the top grossing movie of the year, but definitely one of the top movies of the decade, and was the industry's highest grossing movie for a long, long time. Top grossing movie in 1982, $359 million domestically, $793 million worldwide on a $10 million budget. And, you know, this is during a time period. Jaws was the first movie to crack $100 million, and that became the standard. Mm-hmm. Like, to be considered a box office success, you had to gross $100 million.
Or a blockbuster, at least. If you want to be a blockbuster,
yeah. Imagine a movie at a time when $100 million was considered a success to gross $359 million domestically.
That's over since...
It's total release. It's total grosses domestically. Yeah, but $793 million total worldwide.
E.T. phone home.
E.T. phone home.
I'll be right here.
Now, here's my memory of seeing this film in the theater. So, what was it? That came out in 1982, so I was about 16. And my sisters and my cousins, who were girls, had already seen E.T. And they were like, Joe, you got to see E.T. We got to take you to see E.T. Again, I had to get dragged to the movie theater. I don't know why. I don't know why I was hesitant to go see it. Got dragged to the movie theater, and I remember it, you know, thoroughly enjoying it. And then when E.T. wanders off and gets sick, I remember looking at my sisters and my cousins all staring at me because they wanted to see me weeping. Yeah. And I was sobbing like a baby.
When you're a kid and you see
shut
that.
Shut up. Oh, my God.
When you think
God.
He's dead? I mean, that's...
Yeah,
why the hell
lying
would you do that
in
to...
a ditch. He's
yeah, why the hell
great.
Would you do that to a kid? That's what I'd ask your family. That's what I asked my family. I'm like, why the hell would you do that to me?
Yeah, that... I'm trying to think. That might have been, like, the first movie I saw where I, like, sobbed uncontrollably. That was tough. And then there were just tears of joy when he comes back.
I remember that was one of the first movies where I was actually clapping when... AT and the kids were all riding on their bikes and trying to get away from the authorities so they can get him out of there.
Yeah.
I was like, go, 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 go. Like, this is great.
Yeah. Now, they released that with a special edition, and they made some unnecessary changes. And I guess Spielberg recently said he regretted some of the changes he made.
That's
in
why
the,
I never saw it.
Yeah. In the original movie, the FBI guys or whoever they are were chasing the kids with guns in hand. And I can understand looking back going, that's not cool. They ended up digitally replacing all the guns with walkie-talkies, and
field day with that.
And Spielberg was like, yeah, that might have been a mistake. And also, they did some, they replaced E.T. digitally in some scenes, and it does not have the same effect as that puppeted costume character interacting with the actors, who in some cases, like, you know, Drew Barrymore seeing this thing for the first time and reacting genuinely to it. You don't get those reactions with a digitally created character.
It was a little bit like Yoda, digital Yoda, and like mannequin Yoda.
Yeah. Yep. There's a scene in the re-release where he's puppet. In the bathtub covered in water and like bubbles are coming out of his mouth. And it just, I don't know, it just has a different feel. I like that puppet. And if you get a chance to visit the Academy Museum in LA, they got one of the original animatronic ETs on display, and to look into his eyes and there's glass obviously there, but to see that up close and really scrutinize it, it's emotional.
I'm attached to that movie because that was the first time I also had Reese's Pieces.
Oh yeah,
because when you couldn't really get those in India at the time, so when I finally got a hand. I'm like, Reese's Pieces.
Yeah.
And you just associate that with the movie. So
now talk about, you know, we talk about not having faith in a movie. M&M's was approached and they said, no, we're not interested.
Really?
So they went to Reese's Pieces and they flew off the shelves. Imagine missing that sponsor.
Product placement.
Yeah,
there's a big time. There's a ditch in somewhere in Nevada with a marketing exec who made the wrong choice. A little mound of dirt,
or at the bottom of Lake Mead. Who knows?
yeah. But again, this, like I said, this movie was so huge that it was the number one box office draw for a very long time, and I can't remember what knocked it off its perch. I don't know if it was Titanic or Star Wars movies. I don't remember.
Oh, no. It was probably
Force Awakens, maybe.
I don't know if it was Jurassic Park. I don't know if that came close in 93. Yeah. Jurassic Park came close, but because in the 90s, you started getting these, like, I call the 90s the baseball steroids, where all of a sudden everything started getting augmented. You're like, are these real numbers or not?
Yeah. No. But yeah, it was huge. What a phenomenon. And man, I just remember, you know, being alive during that era, like, that was, nothing was bigger than E.T. when that movie was out. That was incredible. So, all right, I'm going to move on to my next film. This is my number 5 favorite movie that came out in the 80s.
I feel like we're doing David Letterman's top 10.
Now, as long as you don't introduce Stupid Petricks, we'll be fine.
That's right. This movie came out in 1988. It was the number 2 movie of 1988, raking in a total of $330 million. And again, there's some confusing information out there about which movie finished on top, but most sources agree that it was, this is almost kind of hard to believe, that it was beaten by Rain Man. Rain Man grossed $354 million, which is so surprising for that type of movie to be such a huge phenomenon.
I wouldn't have guessed that, yeah.
But the movie I'm talking about...
I'm not bad. I'm just drawn that way.
Yes.
We're talking about Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Now, again, I remember seeing it in theaters with a bunch of friends who grew up on Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse and all that stuff. And to see Disney and Warner Brothers characters on screen at the same time, yeah, and not just those characters, but like Betty Boop and classic characters like that, that was a perfect storm where everything came together for that movie, and then it will never, ever happen again. You'll never see Disney and Warner Brothers characters on screen at the same time. They would never allow that. So I am so grateful that somehow someone, Spielberg, I'm sure, used his power to make this happen. But
talk about an expanded universe.
Yeah.
Or a crossover.
A crossover, yeah, yeah.
The closest that ever came to is Ready Player One. But again, they created another franchise, but they basically tried to borrow from as many as they could. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, again, seeing it in theaters, laughing out loud, the whole noir aspect of it with Eddie Valiant as the grizzled detective, the femme fatale and Jessica Rabbit.
Seeing Daffy Duck and and Donald Duck going at it, like, I can't understand you.
And it was interesting when you hear that Warner Brothers and Disney had to negotiate for screen time. Like, you know, if Bugs is going to be on screen X amount of minutes, then Mickey has to be on screen. Yeah. So they would be on screen simultaneously. And Daffy and Donald, you know, do the dueling piano thing, and they had to be on screen the same amount of time. And so there is a lot of, you know, red tape.
Which, if I'm a director, oh, no, I get to use both of them? Twist my arm.
Yeah. But it was amazing to see that in theaters when it came out. And like I said, we'll never see anything like it again. And when I see on social media people say, what movie would you most want to see a sequel to? It would be Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but we'll never see it. We'll never see it. So we just have to appreciate that one film.
Do you think Steven could use his cloud one last time?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
wow. One last time before he retires. Or
God, can you imagine seeing a sequel that has The Simpsons and SpongeBob and, you know, Rick and Morty, like all in the same film, Ren and Stimpy.
And I love for them to use the same tech, but you could actually make the integration a little bit better now. When they used, I remember they showed Bob Hoskins dragging him to the water.
Yeah, yeah.
They had to do the special
and then they would animate over the top of
it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I remember Bob Hoskins saying that when he had to, like, grab Roger by the neck, he had to learn to keep his fist close, because if his fingers were separated, that meant the animators had to animate between his fingers, which added thousands of dollars to the budget. And I loved hearing stories like that. Like, they would shoot all the live action with the weird little gadgets they would come up with and then animate over the top of it. It was just remarkable. What an accomplishment.
I had an opportunity to get the gun with the bullets in it, with the entire case, and I missed it because I was like, I wonder if I should do this. And I said, I'll come back and get it. And the guy had sold it.
I own it. I wow.
Of course you do.
I
were
own...
you the guy that bought it?
No,
surprise,
no, 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 no.
Surprise.
You can find these online now, especially with 3D printing, but I have the wooden case. You open it up.
Yes.
There's a little metal plaque from Yosemite Sam. It says, thanks for getting me out of the hoosegow, Eddie, or something like that. There's the gun, and then all the row of dum-dums. And it's one of my prized possessions in my collection.
Isn't like the velvet thing where you...
Yeah, yeah, it's like red velvet, wooden case. And
Nick is so jealous right now.
And then you got the voices of like Slim Pickens, you know, which way did he go? Dum-dums. I also made myself, and this took some research, I made what was the guy's name who left the inheritance? So it wasn't Maroon. It was the other guy who owned Acme or whatever. Marvin Acme. I made the disappearing, reappearing letter that had his will with the lipstick handwriting that said, how much do I love thee? Let me count the ways. 1,000, 2,000. So I recreated that letter, and I had to scrutinize frames of Who Framed Roger Rabbit to try and figure out what the content of that letter was. And I think I'm about 90% accurate in that letter. But so imagine that box with the gun in it, that letter. I have a couple of signed 8x10s by Jessica and Roger all in one display. It's pretty cool.
You know, it's who voiced her?
Oh, that was Kathleen Turner of really? Romancing the Stone fame.
I didn't know that.
She voiced.
I can hear it now. It never occurred to me.
Now, she wasn't the singing voice. Somebody else was the singing voice. And forgive me for not knowing that. But Kathleen Turner voiced Jessica.
Idina Menzel?
No. But yeah, that was Kathleen Turner's smoky voice voicing Jessica Rabbit, man.
I just came across this factoid. Have you guys heard the fact of the budget of that movie?
I have it here? No, I didn't write down the budget. What was the budget of Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
So it doesn't say what it originally was, but it soared to $70 million in
88 dollars.
Yeah.
At that time, it was the most expensive budget.
Wow. Yeah.
Ever for a film.
Well, they made good on their investment because today, it grossed a lot of money.
Today, that would have been $150.
Mm-hmm.
And think about, we get several $150 million.
And we get garbage movie. For it.
And, yeah, and we get The Flash or, you yeah. know.
Well, they just announced, what was it? There's a movie that was just announced recently that like ranked up there as one of the highest budgets ever for a film. And I don't know if it was Dune or something like that, but it was in like the $300 million range. It's like, imagine you have to gross $300 million to even think about breaking even today. That's crazy.
Oh yeah, no.
Yeah, the two last Avengers movies, I'm sure, were over 300.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Pretty. I think James Cameron's Avatar movies are probably up there because of the technology they're pioneering.
The last Pirates of the Caribbean at that time was the most expensive, and
You talk about a lot. You just talk.
about a loss.
Just diminishing returns.
Something we're gonna
bury
have to,
it deep.
We're gonna have to dedicate a podcast to the biggest busts of all times. Yeah. The movies that lost the largest amounts of money. That could be a whole podcast.
Imagine having it right and then just fumbling it away.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we need more Will Turner and Keira Knightley. I'm like, no, you have Johnny Depp. You have the character. Oh, guys.
All right, let's move on to our next one. This is widely considered one of the greatest comedies of all time. Top grossing movie of 1984, the year I graduated high school. $229 million domestically, $295 million worldwide on a $25 to $30 million budget at the time. Again, another huge phenomenon.
He slimed me.
Ghostbusters. again, one of the greatest comedies ever made, one of the greatest casts of all time. It's fascinating to think that...
one of the greatest casts. Imagine what it could have been.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. John Belushi was supposed to be in that original cast. I don't know if he was going to be Peter Venkman or which role he was going to be, but that would have been a John Belushi vehicle.
Eddie Murphy.
And Eddie... Oh, yeah. Yeah, when he turned down Ghostbusters and they rewrote the Winston character, and then the actor who played Winston, when he came on board, he thought he was going to be one of the main characters, and then he found out that his role was cut significantly.
It's up to like page 55 or 60.
Yeah, and he was really disappointed because originally it was going to be Eddie Murphy, and that would have been completely different.
Well,
dynamic.
They didn't want to wait for Eddie. That was the thing. Eddie wanted to do it, but it was a scheduling conflict.
Yeah, yeah. So imagine what that would have been. But still, what we did get is one of the greatest movies of all time. And Harold Ramis, who passed away about 10 years ago or so, he had his hands in this and some of the greatest comedies ever made. And I don't think people realize what a genius he was in the world of comedy. He gave us movies. He either wrote or directed or acted in Animal House, Stripes, Meatballs, Ghostbusters, Groundhog Day, you name it. He had his hand, Vacation. I think he directed Vacation, I think. John Hughes wrote it, I believe. So Harold Ramis was just a comic genius. And again, Ghostbusters is a near perfect movie. Just
him and Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a delivery to comedy. I mean, just there's certain things to say. You know, it goes, you're such a great, you're so kind to take care of that man. I don't think he's a man.
Yeah, and you know, Dan Aykroyd. You know, he's a paranormal nut, and he brought a lot of validity to the dialogue. Like, a lot of it is scientifically accurate because he was such a fan of the paranormal, that he brought all his knowledge and the dialogue, and so it all feels very authentic and genuine.
I mean, the only thing, he turns on the their proton packs, and then it's making that humming sound. He stands to the other side of the elevator. I'm like, yep.
Don't cross streams. Yeah.
Next time someone asks you if you're a god, you say yes.
Now, I visited two locations from Ghostbusters. The first one was in New York. We were walking the streets of New York, and we came upon the firehouse, and that was really cool to see. And they really embrace it. It's an active working firehouse today, but there are times where they hang the Ghostbusters logo above the entrance and everything. So they really take pride in the fact that they were Ghostbusters headquarters, even though a lot of the interiors were filmed in L.A. But speaking of L.A., another location that I visited is I was in L.A. in 2019, and I went to the L.A. Comic-Con. And then when I got out of the L.A. Comic-Con, my friends were like, hey, come meet us at the Biltmore Hotel. And so I walked, I don't know how many miles to get to the Biltmore. And I'm like, what's the deal with the Biltmore? And my friend said, you are standing where they film scenes in Ghostbusters. Beverly Hills Cop is where Eddie Murphy's character stayed while he was in Beverly Hills. And I found out recently that's also where the bachelor party was held, in Tom Hanks' bachelor party.
What?
So the Biltmore has a long, long history. And it was really cool to stand in that location where so many great films were made.
I wanted to ask you this. When Ghostbusters came out, it was popular. Was there a sudden spike in hearses being popular like with Ecto-1?
That's a good question. Well, the Cadillac ambulance, I think it's like a 57 or something Cadillac ambulance. They're almost impossible to find now. Uh-huh. People were buying them and turning them into Ectos. And when those got harder, then people were finding other makes and models that were similar to that. But speaking of Ecto, this is kind of a neat story. A friend of mine and I were in L.A. in 2011, and we decided to tour Sony Studios. And it was kind of a rainy day, and we come around the corner, and there sitting outside in the rain was the original Ecto-1. It had been restored. And if you tour Sony Pictures today, which used to be MGM, you will see Ecto-1 on display, the original. So it was really cool to see that in person.
I want to put you on the spot real quick. You have one choice of only one. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang Car Ecto-1 DeLorean. Go.
Only one. Well, there's not many people here in the Detroit area that own a DeLorean replica time machine. I know one person who does. And so I would get a lot of use out of a DeLorean time machine. But
fair enough.
I did sit in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. They have one that was screen used at the Stalls Museum. And they let me sit in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And I almost wept. That was pretty cool. But to own, I would go DeLorean time machine. That would be fun. So... yeah, so any thoughts of Ghostbusters? Do you remember the first time you saw Ghostbusters?
Yeah, it was not something I saw when I was young, like a lot of those other movies. So I think I'm kind of cutting in and out.
It is, yeah.
It's a ghost.
But
there you go.
I saw it freshman year of college, which means I only remember bits and pieces of it.
Have you watched it since?
Absolutely not.
Really?
No, I wow. Just I haven't come across it. From what I remember, I liked it.
Wow.
Of course you did.
But no, I mean, I would love to watch it again sometime. I have not seen the second one. I have not seen any of the sequels.
Well, the second one is the reason why Bill Murray said he would never do a sequel. He was disappointed with the experience of doing Ghostbusters 2, and it's okay, but it's not something I need to rewatch. The first one is a classic.
I don't know if they ever settled on the story. They kept going back and forth on it from what I heard. So, yeah. No, Ghostbusters, if you watch that as a standalone, it's great. It's one of those almost near-perfect comedies.
I agree. Yeah.
Same thing with me and E.T. I saw it only freshman year of college and haven't seen it since. So
okay, you're confessing these things.
I need to revisit that as well.
Ooh, man, I've seen it so many times.
Yeah.
And I've met Henry Thomas, who played Elliot.
Okay.
And way back in 1990, I ran into a young girl named Drew Barrymore on this beach.
I recently saw.
I did see that.
Yeah. Saw a picture on Facebook a couple days ago.
Yeah, her birthday was recently, and
the one that got away.
That's right.
It says in the captions.
Yeah, even though it was a fleeting encounter at Venice Beach, but
sure,
I did have the opportunity when I met Henry Thomas. I said to him, and he seemed genuinely moved by this. I said, "Your performance in E.T. is one of the greatest child performances of all time. It is top 10 easily, if not top 5. His performance was spectacular." And he like paused for a second and said, "Well, wow, thank you." So yeah, that was great. That performance was amazing. Yeah.
I know there in the 80s, there was a lot of sense of adventure for movies. I remember the Goonies, E.T., Explorers, which I'll always love.
Yeah. And Spielberg, you know, had his hand in a lot of those. If he didn't direct a movie, he was producing or executive producing.
Yeah.
And that he's a big reason why there were so many beloved fantasy films during that time period. I mean, he was a producer on Back to the Future. As a matter of fact, I think he's the reason it even got made.
Yeah, he fought for it.
He took his connections. He went to his connections at Universal and said, "You guys need to look at this." So he was on set, you know, for the filming of Back to the Future, and you could see his fingerprints on that film. Yeah. So, all right, next movie here, 1986, number 7 for the year. Grossing $86 million. It was overshadowed by Top Gun, which was the number one movie of the year, $176 million.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
You know, as a kid, I saw Alien, and I thought the original Alien was one of the greatest movies I've ever seen. I remember when it was just a staple on pay-per-view and cable TV. I watched it over and over and over and over and over again. I know every beat, every line. And when the sequel came out, directed by Jim Cameron, he just took the familiar elements from Alien and threw them into a blender with like war movies and stuff, came out with something completely unique and new. It was not a rehash of Alien, and created, again, one of the greatest sequels of all time, and a great cast and great moments, and it was absolutely amazing.
Alien is true horror, and I think, and Aliens is meant to be action. It borrowed from some horror, but
it was
predominantly action. So you could almost treat it as two different movies. Because some people I don't like Aliens because it took away from horror. Like, well, don't look at it. Alien is a standalone horror movie.
Yeah,
right.
Imagine the concept of the alien in the first movie wiping out an entire crew, with the exception of Ripley. Now in the sequel, there's a whole army of these things.
They're like, oh no! Right, and the crew actually has weapons.
In
the second.
Yeah,
and also like you mentioned, Jim Cameron, he was only a year and a half or 2 years removed from doing Terminator.
Yeah,
so that action was still.
Yeah.
Front and center for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Joe, you can pick him. I mean, 1986, if you allow me this. These are the top movies at the time. You don't have to put them in order. Top Gun, Crocodile Dundee, Karate Kid Part 2, Back to School, Aliens, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, Out of Africa, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, The Color of Money, Legal Eagles, Cobra, Jewel of the Nile. These are you talk about Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner's string of doing their own, like they could almost have their own extended universe of franchise.
I need to revisit Romancing the Stone. Romancing the Stone was great. Yeah. Jewel of the Nile was a sequel to
And they were in War of the Roses with Danny DeVito. The Golden Child, which I was, Short Circuit, The Fly.
Oh, Short
Rocky
Circuit.
Rocky IV.
Yes, yes.
I mean, even American Tail.
Yeah. That's a pretty great year for movies. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
The Great Mouse Detective. I always enjoy that one. Spies Like Us, Iron Eagle, Three Amigos.
Oh wow! Yeah.
Now we talk about some of the great movie moments happened in the 80s. This is in my top 10, possibly my top 5, and could be an argument for number one movie moment of the 80s.
Get away from her, you bitch!
Oh, man. When she's trying to protect Newt and she comes out in that power loader suit, I on my feet. Like, that was such an amazing moment in that battle between the two of them. Her just landing haymakers left and right. It was great.
One of the best lines that always stuck with me is for a character who I wish had more time. His name was Frost. When they collect weapons and ammo, it's like, what the hell do you want us to use, man? Harsh language?
right. Or like Bill Paxton, just so many lines. Like, you know, when Ripley says to him, you know, this little girl survived, you know, with nothing. And why don't you put her in charge? You know, and he was so great in that. And I see a meme going around that he's like the only actor that survived an Alien, a Terminator, and there's something else. And he was in Tombstone and Titanic and all sorts of stuff. But
he did not survive a Predator. Predator 2, it killed him.
Oh, but he did go toe-to-toe with the Predator in part 2, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, I mean, yeah. Tip of the hat to him. I was like, Bill, just don't. He's throwing his lucky charm at it.
Yeah, when you think 80s, you gotta give it up for Bill Paxton. He was just great. And, of course, the Chet in Weird Science.
I love that.
Are you wearing panties? That was great. All right, the next movie. Again, this movie came out at the tail end of the decade, but it almost defined the entire decade. I remember the hype that surrounded this movie, the arguments, the debates on whether it was going to succeed or not, because up to this point, the only Batman we had was the TV version and Adam West, and everyone thought we were going to get a movie version of the campy Batman.
What are you?
I'm Batman.
And there is a lot of speculation of Michael Keaton when he was cast. Boy, oh boy, there was no internet back then, but it blew up the internet.
He was known as a comedic actor.
Exactly, yeah.
And I recently came across a video. I didn't watch it, but I saw the blurb that he used to do stand-up.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. Stand-up comedian.
It's not to the same level, but imagine if, you know, even his physical stature, he's not a big guy, and you're thinking about Batman, it'd be like if Rick Moranis was cast as, like, The Flash or something. Like, what?
Yeah, but neither is Christian Bale. So he's not a big guy.
Christian Bale's not a big guy, but when you see him in American Psycho, you're like, okay, I can see this guy as Bruce Wayne. You know, he went from The Machinist, and then he went to Batman. He overshot it, and he was like, we'll put on a little bit of muscle, but.
Now, my defense of Michael Keaton is that he plays crazy well. I mean, when you look at him as Beetlejuice or whatever. And I think that's what Tim Burton was going for. You know, Bruce Wayne, there's something not quite right with a guy who wants to dress up as a bat and go out and fight crime. And I think that's what Keaton brought to the role.
You want
to
get nuts? Let's get nuts.
Yeah, and so he conveyed that really well.
Yep.
I remember when Ben Affleck was announced as Batman, the internet blew up on that one. Yeah. They said there's no way he can do it. And say what you want about the movies, he did well as that character.
Yeah, he did what he could with the material that he was given. Now, I'm kind of excited about something. I don't know if this is going to pan out, and forgive me for not knowing the actor's name, but the guy who plays Reacher in the current TV series.
Is that official?
I don't know, but he's been quoted online as saying he's in the conversation, he's honored. But he would be a Batman unlike anything we've ever seen, like someone who just looks physically imposing. So he's got my vote.
Which I'd like to say at least one thing about Michael Keaton. When he was as Bruce Wayne, like, oh, this guy can't be Batman. When I see the Reacher actor, I'd be like, yeah, I see it.
Yeah.
I know you somewhere. Bruce Wayne, it's something about that build.
Yeah. Yeah, he would be the most physically imposing Batman we've ever seen. But Michael Keaton did what he had to do, and that movie was such a huge phenomenon. I remember walking around with my black t-shirt with the Batman logo on it and having
that was
kid
truly
pass
what I heard. I heard it was nice that was one of the best marketing campaigns that was put out at the time.
Oh, such a huge phenomenon. And the premiere was all over the news.
And Jack Palance and Jack Nicholson to be in that movie. And you got Kim Basinger.
Yeah. And that was kind of an argument too, after the fact, was this a Batman movie or was it a Joker movie? Because I think Nicholson probably got more screen time than Keaton. Like he got a lot of screen time.
He stole the movie.
Yeah.
And going back to marketing, that was the first time I remember getting, either for birthday or gifts, the action figures from that movie. And that was the first time getting an action figure based on a movie in 89.
Yeah.
And I remember I had the Batman. I'm pretty sure I had the Joker. I had, what's his name? Bob the Goon.
Yeah.
And then they had the Topps trading cards.
The Sega Genesis game
with a dry piece of gum in the trading cards.
Sure, yeah.
I had those.
And who won the McDonald's or Burger King that won the bid? Because whoever did, they just got.
Yeah, I don't recall who had the toys or glasses or anything. I want to say Burger King because I seem to remember the glasses, but I'm not sure. Because
that kicked off that trend.
Yeah.
Because then starting that all throughout the 90s, like I remember when the Godzilla movie came out with, what's his face?
Matthew Broderick?
Oh, yeah. Godzilla. Taco Bell won it because that show off. Yo quiero Taco Bell. It's a grande lizard. It's like, all right.
And we also, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up the Batmobile. We had seen the Batmobile on the TV show and some of the animated shows and things like that. But whoever designed this Batmobile for the 89 movie knocked it out of the park. It looked like a jet engine with wheels with the flame coming out of the back, which was an homage to the Batmobile from the TV show.
And they used that in the animated series. They took that design and they put it in there. Yep.
But when they reveal the Batmobile, they're escaping the museum, Batman and Vicki Vale. And he goes, get in the car. And she goes, which one? And then they cut to the wide shot of this black, sleek car sitting out there. What a cool introduction. And then it's just a minute or two of it just zipping down the roads and the leaves blowing and that flame coming out of the back. And it was love at first sight for me, man. That was a badass Batmobile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Boy, that was fun. Yeah. All right, next up, number 9 on my list. Again, this came out the year I graduated high school, 1984. Number 2 movie of 1984, $224 million behind Ghostbusters. This is one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
I need a couple of bananas. How much are they?
Well, the buffet plate is $12.50. You get peaches, plums, oranges, and bananas.
Well, all I need is a couple of bananas.
Damon Wayans.
Take those bananas.
That might have been the very first time I've ever seen Damon Wayans in any role, and he got huge after that. But Beverly Hills Cop, I remember seeing on the news, they're filming a movie in Detroit this week, and there's footage of the truck and cigarettes flying out of the truck, and people would run out onto the street and grab the cigarette boxes as they flew out of the truck, and it was on the news that they were filming this. And then, of course, when Beverly Hills Cop came out, it just changed everything. Now, Eddie Murphy had done 48 Hours, I believe. I think that was his first movie after SNL. But when he did Beverly Hills Cop, he hit the stratosphere. I mean, another perfect movie on every beat, the right mix of comedy and tragedy. And, oh, my gosh.
If I may, 1984, Conan the Destroyer, The Last Starfighter, The Terminator. These are all the Red Dawn. These are all the Revenge of the Nerds, The Natural, Purple Rain, Romancing the Stones, Terms of Endearment, Star Trek III, Beverly Hills Cop, Footloose, Police Academy, Karate Kid, Gremlins, Indiana Jones, Temple of Doom, say what you will, but it belongs in the trilogy, and then Ghostbusters.
And Ghostbusters.
Wow.
Think about this. Almost every movie you listed there I saw in the theater that year, so I must have been in the theater every week to have seen just about every movie you listed.
But if that's the summer, that was you get out of high school, and then that's your summer. Every summer, there's someone competing for you.
Oh, man. Yeah, Beverly Hills Cop just epitomized the 80s and Eddie Murphy. There's no one bigger in the 80s than Eddie Murphy, who had hit after hit after hit, 48 Hours, Trading Places, Golden Child, you name it. Just hit after hit after hit. It was just amazing.
Coming to America.
Again, one of the greatest comedies of all time. Definitely top 10 for me. So, yeah, such a great movie. And now I'm going to hit number 10, and then we'll kind of go around the table. Now, this is kind of shocking. I was surprised when I dug this up in my research. It was the number 10 movie of 1988, which in hindsight, it's kind of shocking. You'd think it would have ranked a lot higher. It is, let's see, I got a clip here somewhere. I should have had it ready. But this is one of the most iconic movies to come out of the 80s.
Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
I thought about censoring that, and I'm like, no, I'm not going to censor it. Most people consider it one of the greatest Christmas movies of all time. Die Hard epitomized the 80s. Bruce Willis left Moonlighting to do Die Hard and became one of the biggest action stars on the
planet.
And
no one thought he would do it. No one could see him because they always saw him as Moonlighting.
Yeah. And again, another perfect
same thing
movie.
With Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
Because he had only done comedy before.
Yeah. Yeah. Alan Rickman knocked it out of the park and went on to have an amazing career. And again, just, you know, a movie's great when it becomes parodied and copied and spoofed over the next 20 years.
And still talked about in 2024.
I don't know if any of the sequels rival it, but the first one, in my opinion, is one of the greatest movies ever made.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I enjoyed the third one when they went back to New York with Die Hard with Samuel L. Jackson. But on the first one, I love the things. Were you there? That's just before you got to L.A., right, Joe?
It came out in 88. I moved to L.A. in 89, yeah.
So because I know a lot of people saying they were complaining of the film that
Nakatomi.
They were saying all the local business going, what's going on? Wait till you shoot to five. I don't know what's going on. I'm like, you're in L.A. It's a movie production. Where do you guys think you're living? Oh, you know, like Tulsa? I mean.
Yeah. And a lot of those explosions and stuff were done with miniatures. So yeah. I can't imagine they were setting off big explosions at the building. Of course, that was a location I had to visit when I was in L.A. Went over to the Nakatomi Plaza and got some pictures over there. That was pretty cool. I think it's called the Fox Plaza.
Yeah.
I
love the little tidbit that they did with Alan Rickman when they were going to do the drop scene. They didn't tell him when they were dropping him, so that expression on his face is genuine shock.
They were like, we're going to drop you on three. One, drop.
Boom.
And he thought something had gone wrong and was falling to his death or something. But, yeah, that's a genuine expression. And so much more authentic than the drop in RoboCop. Do you remember when the guy in RoboCop goes out the window and he's got these long, weird arms and he looks like a stop-motion puppet? And it's like, why did you make that decision? To see that look on Alan Rickman's face as he starts dropping out of that window. And then the line when they follow him all the way down to the ground and the cop goes, I hope that's one of them. Not one of ours. So what a perfect movie. Great movie.
The principal from Breakfast Club.
Yeah, that's right.
I hope that's not hostage.
So your memories of Die Hard?
Also, saw it once.
Wow. These are classics, man.
Saw it once in college. Haven't seen it since.
Wow.
From what I little bit of it, I remember. I liked it.
Wow.
I'm glad at least there's part of your brain says, we liked it. Just give me happy memories on this one.
All right, so that's my top 10. Nick, what are some titles that come to mind that we haven't touched on yet?
Well, for me, like I said, I enjoyed a lot of the sci-fi and adventure type stuff. So I enjoyed The Explorers. I enjoyed Goonies. So anything that had a lot of kid adventures. That's why also I have a soft spot for Temple of Doom because it has Short Round in it.
Yeah.
And I'd seen, and then I saw Goonies. I didn't watch these in order. I said, oh, it's Short Round.
Yeah.
And it's Goonies. And so and now to see that he's won an Oscar.
Yeah, and he's making a comeback in his career is pretty awesome.
You know, and he's in Loki in season two. But so I really have a soft spot for the sense of adventure in the movies. You know, you talk about movies like Krull. You know, no one really ever talks about that. And they had Willow.
Yeah.
You know, so in the 80s, they were always about fantasy adventure movies. Even Black Cauldron came out. And Black Cauldron, if anyone doesn't know, that was a Disney movie. It's the first time Disney went dark, like as in like the scary stuff. And they didn't recover until they came out with Little Mermaid in 89.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But no, I enjoyed the 80s. Like their movies, like I said, on my Mount Rushmore, I didn't get Aliens in there. I didn't get Ghostbusters in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just going from 84 to about 88, when you look at the top grossing movies and the top movies in there, a lot of these are in AFI's top 100 and whatever genre you want to go through, action, comedy, sci-fi, drama. So most of my top 10 reflects yours, but
yeah,
I will always have a soft spot for sci-fi and comedy. So
I love the action flicks. You know, you can't talk about the 80s without talking about Schwarzenegger, Stallone, Willis,
Van Damme.
Their movies, Van Damme.
Yeah, The Predator. Ooh,
yeah.
That was a big one for me.
Yeah, you know, there's a. I have on my list some of the movies that came out in the 80s that weren't necessarily initially box office phenomenons, but they've stood the test of time and are really beloved now. And Predator is one of them. I mean, that's another movie I'll
sit
and watch.
If it bleeds, you can kill it.
Yeah, or the line when he's like, "You're bleeding, man. I ain't got time to bleed." Those are such great lines. Carl Weathers, Jesse Ventura, and Arnold. Mm-hmm. And,
I remember
so great.
In the 80s, he had Conan, two Conan movies.
Yeah.
And he had twins with Danny DeVito. I love when they finally figured out and they said, well, this Arnold represents all the good and great stuff and all the shit left over turned. And they look at Danny DeVito. And I'm like,
yeah, when they reveal that to him.
I'm like, that's cold blooded.
You were the byproduct. Yeah. He did Commando. True Lies was incredible.
Yeah.
That's a 90s movie, though.
That was it. But he could do no wrong. Like Schwarzenegger, I mean, it was almost kind of a cartoon character, but he defined the action
Running Man.
Flick.
Oh, my God. Yep.
Incredible. Then he kind of parodied himself in the Super Bowl commercial where what was the word he kept trying to say?
Neighbor.
Get to the chopper. It's great that he can laugh at himself, but he's really embraced.
They parody that in The Simpsons when they did the Radioactive Man. Up and at them. Up and at them.
Up and better. Up and at them. Up and at them.
The dialect coach is better.
Oh my gosh. And then, of course, RoboCop, another movie that wasn't necessarily a huge box office hit, $53 million on a $13 million budget, so it was profitable. But that movie has gone on to become a beloved classic. And The Thing, which is one of my all-time favorite horror movies, came out in 1982. This is shocking when I was looking this up. $20 million on a $15 million budget. And when you read the reviews of The Thing from like Siskel and Ebert and other critics of the era, they freaking hated it. They basically called it horror porn. Like it was, they despised it. And now most people regard it as one of the greatest sci-fi horror movies of all time.
It's good to know, you know, some of their stuff didn't age well. Siskel and Ebert, because you go, come on, guys, get off your high horse.
And they did, like, over the years, they did kind of go back and look at movies that they ended up revising their opinion of, like, okay, we screwed up on that. And I don't know if they ever admitted that on The Thing, but, again, I saw The Thing in theaters, and I was so blown away. Same thing with The Fly. Like, yeah, some of the effects were over the top and stomach-churning, but you walked out of there like, I need to see that again. Like, that was incredible.
I mean, An American Werewolf in London.
Yeah.
Came out in the 80s. You talk about some really iconic horror movies that came out.
The Howling. You ever see The Howling?
Yep.
Some of the most amazing werewolf transformation scenes because they were all real world effects. It wasn't this CGI garbage that we see today that guys like Rick Baker had to devise contraptions to make a human's face stretch out into the snout of a werewolf.
In Fright Night, when his buddy transformed.
Yeah. Yeah, and Fright Night, again, one of my all-time favorite movies. And it only grossed $25 million on its initial release on a $7 to $9 million budget. But now Fright Night's one of my all-time favorite horror movies because I love when comedy and horror comes together.
Yeah.
And there are laugh out loud moments in Fright Night and genuinely scary, frightening moments. And I'll never forget the reveal they did with Amy when she's in that sexy dress and she blames Charlie for what's happening to her. And he feels sympathetic. And then she raises her head. She has this toothy smile that goes from ear to ear. And I remember in the theater going, literally screaming out loud. And when I see stuff like that, I'm like, I got to see that again.
I mean, even though it was an action flick, whenever I hear the motion tracker from Aliens, I instantly go, oh, crap. It's just like a sound that goes, oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah. Andrew, you throw some titles at us that we haven't discussed.
I know we don't have a lot of time left. Two films we have not mentioned. And two of my favorite films, but they're at the opposite ends of the spectrum of each other, Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
My favorite comedy.
Love that.
Favorite comedy of all time. And then Full Metal Jacket. My favorite war movie.
I know a lot of people.
I'm surprised Platoon didn't make it on there.
Platoon is in my top five.
There you go. All right.
Favorite war movies.
Yeah.
And I was just looking up because I never looked at the budget for Pee-wee. It made almost six times its budget.
Yeah.
It had a budget of seven, and it made almost $42 million. So yeah. That's not bad for Tim Burton's first feature film.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I was one of those, I was a young adult getting up early on Saturday mornings to watch Pee-wee's Playhouse. And I loved Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And I did visit his house. You could visit his house in Pasadena. But one of my fondest memories of all time was meeting Paul Reubens where was it? The L.A. Comic-Con, I believe it was, where I stood in a long, long line and to get a photo op.
You got the picture to prove it at your desk.
Yeah, it's in my office, and his passing hit me hard because he's one of my all-time favorites. And I was devastated when he went through that controversy when he got busted in a movie theater in Florida. And it took a while for him to recover from that, but eventually people forgave him. But he, Pee-wee's Big Adventure is one of my all-time favorite movies, not just of the 80s, but just period.
Same here.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you said, we're just about out of time. Some titles I want to throw out, of course, Return of the Jedi, 1983. The Last Crusade, where the Indiana Jones trilogy kind of redeemed itself after Temple of Doom and Last Crusade.
And the last Indiana Jones movie, as far as I'm concerned. That was my train stop. I'm riding off into the sunset.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yep.
I got to play this.
I said it before and I'll say it again. Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Great, great movie. Coming to America, one of the all-time greatest comedies, 1988. We barely scratched the surface on the Rocky movies. As much as I love the first Rocky movie, which came out in the 70s, I'm kind of partial to Rocky III. I love Rocky III with Mr. T. And Rocky III was the first time he delivered this line.
No, I don't hate Balboa, but I pity the fool, and I will destroy any man who tries to take what I got.
What's your prediction for the fight, then?
Prediction?
Yes, prediction.
Pain.
Mr. T. Gotta love Mr. T. What would the 80s be without
And the
Mr.
Rambo Ryan? Movies.
Yeah, Rambo movies, yeah. Yep. And then I gotta say this, too. Superman 2, 1980, kind of kicked off the decade. I feel that Superman 2 actually... superseded the first one.
Yes,
I think
it's
a better movie than the first one with the hero and villain dynamics and the storyline.
I could have taken the origin stuff of the first Superman movie and put it in Superman 2, and that would have been a great movie. Just left it at that.
You're right. So that's pretty much my list. Some other movies I just got to throw out that weren't necessarily box office smashes when they came out. National Lampoon's Vacation did not crack the top 10 for 1983, but has since become a beloved classic.
Yep.
The Breakfast Club did not crack the top 10 for 1985. Princess Bride. Another one that it didn't crack the top 10, and it was bested by movies like Three Men and a Baby, which
we never mentioned Scarface.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I last time I watched Scarface, I'm like, this is almost a comedy when you watch it now. To my little friend.
Or we mentioned in passing about Footloose.
Those cockroach.
Cockroach.
Footloose, Flashdance.
Oh, my gosh.
What was Dirty Dancing?
Yeah.
Roadhouse.
So many. Roadhouse.
Roadhouse.
They're doing a remake.
Yeah, aren't they?
Yeah, like I said, very loose remake.
They're nipping at the edges of the 80s movies, what they can get away with.
Yeah. So, again, we're going to wrap things up, but growing up in the 80s for me as a teenager, I would not change anything, and I would give anything to be able to relive that decade with the movies and music and fashion and the Bengals, my all-time favorite band.
Bengals.
They
owe you some money for royalties.
They do. That's right.
I heard that story. But, Joe, before we go, Nick and I, we have a present
what
for you for not only hosting our previous show, our current show, but also everything you do around here.
Oh, thanks.
Helping everybody, being a great teacher.
Yes.
Both in the podcast and in the studio. I found this at a vintage shop in Waterford. I saw it, and I thought you would love it. That's an that's an original early 80s Mad magazine.
Wow.
And it talks mostly about 80s films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So that is yours, my friend.
I have to give full credit to Andrew on
this.
Thank
you so much.
Andrew did the heavy lifting on that. Basically, he had the idea. He went and got it.
Oh, cool. And on that note, we're going to end with our little ditty. And I believe when we meet again, the Oscars will be the topic of discussion. We're just at the time of this recording, less than 2 weeks away from the Oscars.
So I'm looking forward to it.
We will see you again soon.
Thank you for listening.
Night, everybody.
Come to the movies. Watch Charlie Chaplin and put some sunshine into your day.